Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
In a world of endless notifications, there could be an important one you're missing. Your kidneys may be signaling an SOS. With high blood pressure or type 2 diabetes, your kidneys could be warning you of early signs of damage, which may put you at higher risk for events like heart attack or stroke. But there's a simple test that can help spot a hidden signal. Ask your doctor about a urine test called UACR to help detect kidney disease and heart risk early. To learn more, visit detecttheSOS.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Some good news out of Tangipahoa Parish. The Amber Alert has been canceled for that kidnapped 2-year-old child taken from the I-55 rest stop welcome center early this morning. Tangipahoa Parish Sheriff's Office says the child has been located safely, was asleep in the back of the vehicle that apparently had been left in a parking lot in the Kentwood area. So the child alive and well. The search for the kidnapper continues. More details as they become available. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Thanks for joining us. Here on this first day of October, many people celebrating the arrival of October because they can put out their Halloween decorations without their neighbors raising their eyebrows at them. They can start buying and consuming all their pumpkin spice favorites. But it's not a great day for everyone because new tariffs take effect today. To help us understand what those tariffs are and how they may impact us, we welcome in Patrick Penfield, a professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. Welcome to the fourth quarter of the year. May feel like fall up there, but we'll be in the 90s again today down here. So,
oh, interesting, interesting.
Yeah. What's your high temperature today? Do you know?
Probably be, I think, the 70s. We're not too bad. We're not too far off from you. So we've actually had a very nice weather here in Syracuse.
Okay. Well, highs in the 70s would be significantly better than highs in the 90s that we're dealing with. You actually get fall. We're not having that yet. So October 1st means new tariffs. What are those new tariffs going to be on, and how are they going to affect us all?
Yeah, so, Dave, we got 10% tariff on lumber, 25% tariff on kitchen cabinets, bathrooms, furniture, 100% tariff on movies that are made outside the United States. So, it's crazy. So, unfortunately, the amount of money we've brought in from tariffs have tripled. So, in 2024, we brought in about $10 billion a month. Now we're bringing in about $30 billion a month.
All right. So will that dramatic increase mean things will be more expensive if I'm remodeling my bathroom or I'm buying new furniture? Will that mean that I'm paying more for all of that as a consumer?
Yeah, you'll probably see that like in a month or two because, you know, you've got retailers that have a lot of inventory that they still have to move through. So eventually that cost will be passed on to the consumer. So last month, we saw a 2.9% increase in inflation from last year. So, you know, everything is going up, and I know a lot of your listeners are probably seeing that too. And so that's the unfortunate thing with the tariffs.
What if I'm building a home or need lumber for something else? Am I going to feel that pinch, or do I still have a couple of months before those kick in as well?
He probably got a couple months, but eventually, you know, it does eventually going to hit the supply chain as far as costs go. So, we're starting to see it creep up now. So we've been fortunate because gas and prices have been down or flat. So it really hasn't, we haven't seen that impact yet, but it's coming, unfortunately.
Yeah, I need some new deck boards. I may want to get those sooner than later, huh, to replace the ones that are falling apart on my deck. Maybe do that now instead of waiting till they run out of those supplies. But we've seen before where some of these tariffs kick in, but before we feel the pain of them, the White House cancels the tariffs or negotiates a new trade deal to reduce their impact. What do you expect? Will these tariffs be with us for the foreseeable future, or do you see any scenario in which they get pulled back?
You know, Dave, your guess is as good as mine. I think that's a dilemma. So if you're in business these days, it's this uncertainty that's driving everybody crazy. You know, in business, we like certainty because you want to know what the price is so that way you can charge your customer the right amount and hopefully be able to make a profit. These days, everything's just all over the place. And so I think that's the frustrating part about being in business these days is just trying to understand what is the price. You know, so I assume like you do, Dave, that probably there'll be some negotiations that go on. But some of the stuff is sticking, you know, from a price standpoint. And eventually, if I told you, you know, the tariffs have tripled, it's over $30 billion a month versus $10 billion a month from last year. Absolutely. So, you know, the stuff is sticking. We're seeing, again, these price increases from the tariffs.
How much lumber do we import in the United States? I know that furniture, completed, finished, built furniture, the vast majority of it is coming from Asia and Europe now in the United States. What about that raw lumber? Is that mostly coming from Canada, or where are we getting our lumber?
Yeah, most of our lumber, the raw lumber comes from Canada. We support ourselves a lot with lumber, too. So I'd say probably 20 to 30%. It's all about price, you know. So, you know, I've got some builder friends, and they'll tell me that, you know, the price is good in Canada. But when you have these tariffs that come on, it equalizes it, and it's difficult to, you know, purchase lumber from Canada when price goes up. So then, you scurry and try to find. Yeah, and it's always about the quality and the type of lumber, right? So that's your other dilemma is you've got to make sure the species is what you want and what you need. And for some of these builders, the only species that they can get is, from Canada for that particular lumber that they use for their building.
So they have some things available north of the border that are not produced in the lower 48.
Exactly. And that's the dilemma. And that's what kind of, you know, again, if you're a builder, you're kind of, you know, it's driving you crazy.
The stated goal of these tariffs, I guess there's two basic goals that the president has expressed, that the tariffs are one, to try and level the playing field so that we are on an even playing field with our trade partners across the border and overseas, and two, to try and boost domestic production of all these things that the tariffs are going up on. How is that working out in terms of reciprocal tariffs from these other nations? Are they tariffing the United States like the United States is doing to them? And is it leading to a boom in domestic production, or at least the groundwork being laid to start more production here in the United States?
So, you know, great question, Dave. So we really, from a business standpoint, really haven't seen that growth yet. And so I think that's one of the issues that the president is kind of seeing is that, again, and I support the, you know, manufacturing in the United States because I think that does create wealth. And I think that has been one of his goals is, again, to get more manufacturing here in the States, which makes a lot of sense. And that's what creates wealth in a society. So you want that. It's just the way you go about doing that. And so, unfortunately, the tariffs, what's really going on, Dave, is companies aren't really moving stuff here yet. They're just moving to different countries to get a lower price. So we haven't seen that.
So if the tariff goes up in country A overseas, but not as much in country B, they'll move their manufacturing to country B instead of bringing it home to the United States.
Exactly. That's exactly what's going on right now. And wow. So that's why we haven't seen this renaissance in manufacturing here in the States yet.
All right, we're talking about the new tariffs that kick in today on this 1st of October with Professor Patrick Penfield. When we come back, we'll talk about pharmaceuticals and movies. How does that work in terms of tariffs? We'll find out what that'll mean for you after this check on WWL Traffic. Texts are coming in on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. A lot of people wanting to know when they're going to have to pay higher prices for all these things that they're facing new tariffs on starting today. And as you heard from our expert, that it's going to be until they kind of get rid of what they've got. Professor of Supply Chain Practice at Syracuse University, Patrick Penfield, is with us. Can you tell us, Professor, about pharmaceuticals and tariffs on those?
Yeah, that one's an interesting one. So Dave, I think for your listeners, I wouldn't be too concerned. And the reason being is that 90% of the pharmaceuticals that we use here in the States are generics, and that generics is not going to be tariffed whatsoever. And then we do get some brand name medications made from Europe, and that's already an established deal, 15% tariff rate. So you might see a slight increase on that, but I think overall you're going to be fine. The other thing is that President Trump's saying that, hey, you won't get hit with a tariff if you are building a production facility here. And most of these big pharma companies are doing that. So they've got construction going on. So there's stuff in the works. So I think for that particular situation, for your listeners, I wouldn't be too concerned about, prices going up because of tariffs. Maybe for other things, but not because of tariffs.
Well, and for most folks, those pharmaceuticals, they have insurance or government assistance, and the rates are kind of set for what you pay for a prescription. So I guess until the renewal for your policy, that can't change, right?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, it's set. Whatever has been negotiated between insurance carriers and the pharma companies, that shouldn't go, this shouldn't be impacted for this year. Maybe for next year, again, probably will go up, but not for this year.
Making of movies. This is one that to me was very interesting because most of these products, what's happening is when they are imported, when they come into a port, when they come into a border crossing here in the United States, that's when the tariff is applied, right? It's when they analyze what is in this container, what is in this truck, what are you bringing into the U.S., and then they apply the tariffs and charge those who are importing it. With a movie, how does that work? Because movies don't actually get imported across a border. They're digitally distributed now. How do you see the government enforcing that? And that's 100% tariffs on foreign-made movies and television shows?
Yeah, I actually, Dave, to be quite honest with you, I can't see how that would be administered. I don't know how they would audit that. You know, most of your movies, they do produce a lot of them here in the States. And then they produce scenes, from, other parts of the world just because they have to have that scene for their particular movie. So I don't know how you would do that. I don't know how you would look at it. Would you look at it from a percentage standpoint? Would you look at, the movie itself and then look at the content? So I think for the most part, again, I think that's more bluster. I think it would be a nightmare to try to figure out how much to tariff a company. Now, if you're saying, hey, it's a Bollywood movie and you're going to be, maybe you might be able to tax the theater for that. But I think, overall, I don't know how you would be able to control that. I think that would be a nightmare.
Yeah. And if it's partially filmed domestically, partially filmed out of the country, to what percentage of the tariff applies to what percentage of the movie, it seems very difficult to enforce. I understand the effort to try and get more domestic production of films and television shows, especially where we've seen so much Canadian production in recent years. But yeah, that seems like it's hard. Overall, are these tariffs working to accomplish their goals, and are they leading to higher inflation?
Yeah, I don't think we're seeing the manufacturing that we thought we would see from the tariffs, Dave. I think what we are seeing is the increase in prices. And so, unfortunately, that hasn't happened yet. And so, hopefully, if that's, again, President Trump's plan to get more manufacturing here in the States, we'll start seeing that hopefully in 2026. So far, nothing's really materialized that we thought it would happen.
Professor, thank you so much for joining us. Enjoy your first day of October.
You too, Dave. Have a great day.
Thank you. Professor Patrick Penfield here on WWL. Kind of interesting that we're now playing a game of whack-a-mole where companies are moving from higher tariff countries overseas to other lower tariff countries overseas instead of bringing their production back to the U.S., not quite falling in line with what the White House had hoped. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the government shutdown and how it may impact you on WWL. Magic School Bus, Kids Incorporated, Captain Kangaroo, The Electric Company, just some of the shows that our listeners are texting us on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870 that they would like to see rebooted. Reading Rainbow is coming back to YouTube after a 20-year absence from PBS this weekend. What shows would you like to see rebooted from your childhood? Keep the text coming, and we'll read some more of them throughout the hour here on WWL. We just got the new Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, known in the industry as the JOLTS report, and the government shut down at midnight. How are these things going to impact you, your finances, and your daily life? Well, let's find out from Mark Hamrick at Bankrate. Morning, Mark.
Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. Is there a show from your childhood that you would like to see rebooted, like Reading Rainbow is coming back this weekend?
Well, I mean, you know, part of the assumption of the answer is that it could be done, right? In other words, that something that was magical to begin with can have that same magic once again. And how many times have we gone to the movie to see something rebooted and you're like, okay, we should have stuck with the first one.
Yes, sometimes they're a hit, but usually they're not, yeah.
I'm going to make a travel recommendation here for folks because it's related to the answer, and that is my wife and I drove to the hamlet of Jamestown, New York, which is not far from Lake Erie and near western New York, the birthplace of Lucille Ball. And there's a magnificent, relatively new museum there called the National Comedy Center. Highly recommended. It's, you know, not a destination most people would go to, but it's in the same town where they have the Lucille Ball Desi Arnaz Museum. And they had the immersive Laugh-In exhibit there, Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, which was just heavenly. And that, you know, and they caught lightning in a bottle on that show. A lot of famous people were given their start or given a nudge in that show. And the comedy sketches were very timely. President Nixon, for example, was among those who appeared on the show. And, you know, if I could bring that back and make it just as good, that would be amazing.
Yeah, that's the catch, making it just as good. Someone else wants to see Mr. Rogers rebooted, Romper Room. I don't know. I don't know if you can bring them back and make them as good. So maybe we'll just leave them in our past and go relive them on streaming somewhere. In our future, though, maybe some impact from the government shutdown. But first, let's talk about this JOLTS report, the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. It's just out. What did we learn from that about how things are going economically in the United States?
It's a good indication, Dave, that the job market just really isn't budging much. And that's been the primary complaint of late, that people who are engaged in job searches are finding them to be frustratingly long. That is something that the graduating class of 2025 from earlier this year has been experiencing. And it's interesting because the unemployment rate of 4.3% is still historically low. But to the data that we got in the report, the number of job openings, 7.2 million, a very little change, although it did exceed expectations. And that is essentially giving us a situation where the number of job openings is roughly parallel to the number of people who are unemployed and seeking jobs.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, we had a local small business survey out yesterday that found the biggest complaint from employers, not only here, but nationwide right now, is that they're having trouble finding qualified job applicants. So we have applicants saying it's too long to find a job, and we have employers saying it's too hard to find good job applicants. There's some disconnect there.
Well, there's always been a skills mismatch, and this speaks to, you know, how are people essentially situated with respect to the skills they bring to a prospective employer. I've heard going back for many years that very often employers are very concerned about the lack of so-called soft skills that job applicants possess. So, for example, that might be, are you a great team member? Do you interact well with the public if the job requires that? How are your communication skills? Do you collaborate well? Those are things that it's unlikely you're going to be taught in college. And for hard skills, in other words, things that you do learn in school or at least have to be taught, You know, much of that revolves around artificial intelligence now or technology skills. Those also are not always the skills that we need if we go to a four-year school. So there is a mismatch there, and that's not going to be resolved anytime soon.
All right. We'll find out after this from Mark Hamrick how Wall Street is responding to this jobs report and what it means economically for us. And we'll also talk about how the government shutdown is impacting us after we check on WWL traffic. Talking with Bankrate senior economist Mark Hamrick. Mark, how are the markets reacting to this jobs report that finds essentially no growth but no decline in job openings?
Well, and let's say this morning, the futures market indicates we have a modest decline on tap for the stock market on the order of between 1/3 and 0.5%. So that is just another day on Wall Street. The markets are going to regard this as potentially an inconsequential event. Obviously, if it continues as long as it did last time, which was 35 days, that's much more consequential. So investors are at least hoping that this doesn't have a lasting economic impact. But it does create a problem, Dave, because we won't be getting the monthly employment report that would have been due on Friday. And so at a time when the economy is seen at a potential inflection point, jobs creation slowing, we're not going to have that visibility on what's actually happening, at least through the lens of very important government data.
We are still seeing lots of inflation, whether it's from the tariffs or from other economic factors. How is that impacting the markets? And that with the government shutdown, what does that mean for our daily lives?
Americans' principal complaint about the economy is elevated prices, and that's the result of inflation. And tariffs basically have two essential economic impacts. One is to create headwinds for the economy, to slow growth, and growth over the next foreseeable future is expected to be somewhat subpar in the United States. The other is to create pressure to the upside with prices. And so if the Fed were in the process of winning the war against inflation, it now has other battles to wage because tariffs are continuing to cause that.
Will the government shutdown, will you and I feel it in our daily lives? Obviously, in your professional life, you will, because you're not getting government data during the shutdown. But will the average American be impacted by the shutdown?
Not visibly. You know, if they want to get some non-essential services from the federal government, those aren't going to be available. But so-called essential services are delivered, such as air traffic control, you know, law enforcement, the military, those kinds of things. But if you're going about something that is less complicated, less crucial, you won't get those services, and some federal institutions will be closed. If you're a business that relies on the federal government, if you run a sandwich shop, et cetera, that federal workers frequent, you're not going to get that business.
That's a good point. Yeah, we're right near, our studios are right next to the federal building in downtown New Orleans. Should be easier for us to park around here, and we won't have to wait in as long of lines at the local restaurants, but that's not good for them, and while it may be for us. Mark, thank you so much for joining us, and let's see what happens with your suggestion that we see a laugh-in reboot, if it can be done right. Have a great week.
Thank you, my friend.
Mark Hamrick here on WWL. All right, coming up next hour, we're going to take a look at, now that it's October 1st, where is the cooler weather? Do we have any reasonable expectation of any crisp, cool fall air coming anytime soon? And last year was wild, where we went from summer to snow before we even got to Mardi Gras and the Super Bowl. What is the long-term outlook? Look, we'll check in with the state climatologist coming up after the news. 7:15, in for Tommy Tucker. Thanks for joining us here on WWL, and welcome to October. But we're going to have near record high temperatures again today. And are there any cold fronts in our foreseeable future? Let's check in with the man who's charged to keep track of such things and share them with us, Jay Grimes, the state climatologist for the state of Louisiana. Morning, Jay.
Hey, Dave. Good morning.
How you doing?
How are you today? I'm doing good. Getting ready, actually, to teach a class here at GOSEP. I'm going to go all day looking at a variety of weather features. So before we get to that, let's chat.
Yeah, absolutely. I had to cut the grass yesterday, but in the afternoon I decided it was too hot, so we're going to finish today before it gets hot, because we were up to 92 degrees at my house yesterday, the last day of September. Here we are, October, near record highs again today, right?
Yeah, 90s are going to be the rule for today, and we'll start to see a little bit of a break, and ultimately maybe even a little bit of rain in the coming days, but we're starting to get a little dry, especially in southeast Louisiana, where we're starting to see some minor to moderate drought conditions developing.
Yeah. Is this the new normal, or is this just the way things are going this year? I mean, I think back to 2019 when it was ridiculously hot, even into October, and we not quite as bad the last few years, but this year again, here we are in the 90s as October begins.
Yeah, I mean, 90s in early to mid-October are not all that rare, but they're certainly not what we hope for. October is supposed to be festival month as long as the tropics are behaving, and things are going to steadily start to cool down as we work our way through the month. But maybe the good news is, though, even though it was awfully hot yesterday and today's going to be a repeat, at least the humidity's been manageable.
Yeah, the 2 points have not been oppressive, but none of that crisp, cool air that we'd like to feel with those north breezes. Is any of that in our foreseeable future? Do you see any fronts making it down here anytime soon?
Anytime soon, probably not, at least not what we'd like to think of as one of those real fall fronts. It's probably not in the offing all that soon, but they will start to roll in. It looks like October, though, in general, is going to be a very warm month across the central Gulf Coast region.
All right, so maybe not. I know that we always hope that by Halloween we'll get a cool down, but some years we don't even make it by then. What does the long-range forecasting tell you, and what factors are there in terms of La Nina or anything else that are influencing what we should expect for October?
A good point. For October and heading through the rest of the year, probably going to lean a little on the warm side and probably also a little on the dry side. And the big reason for that is El Nino's evil twin sister, La Nina, is going to be kicking in. Now, La Nina typically leads to drier than normal conditions across South Louisiana. So that's why we're going to keep our eyes on a developing drought in the southeastern part of the state especially. But we're likely to see it all along and south of the I-1012 corridor. Now, drought in the winter isn't necessarily, late fall and winter isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's good for agriculture in the sense that it lets farmers get in and out of the fields without tracking too much mud. And as long as it's relatively not too dry, typically as we get into late fall and winter, we get more than enough rainfall anyway. So a little bit of a reduction in that rainfall doesn't really hurt us all that much. So the big story here is, yeah, the AC is probably going to be working through a good bit of October, maybe even into November. And if you're trying to get that fall garden rolling or keeping that grass green, probably going to have to break out the hose.
Yeah, but on the flip side, we won't have to cut the grass as often and hopefully not pull as many weeds. So there is the good news. Also good news is that while we have seen very little rain, one of the reasons is we've had no tropical systems along the Gulf Coast. In fact, we've not had a single landfalling tropical system this hurricane season. Do you see that trend continuing?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those cases where it's good to be wrong. I really expected, in fact, I think the consensus was a much more active season basin-wide than what we've seen. And we've only had one named storm in the entire Gulf, and that went into Mexico. That was back in the early part of the season. Yeah, the central Gulf Coast has been dead quiet. I can't say that's going to be the case, but I'm leaning that way. Because especially for Louisiana and points west, our season kind of unofficially ends at the end of October. We've only seen one November storm hit Louisiana over 120 years, and that just barely clipped the southern extreme part of Plaquemines Parish. So we're getting to that place where things do get quieter as we get into the second half of October, especially. But if you look back historically, there have been some October monsters. That includes, if you remember, just a handful of years ago, 2020, we had both Delta and Zeta hit Louisiana in October. So we don't want to let our guard down just yet, but things do look like they're going to be quieting down. And right now, we're not even seeing any tropical waves get into the Gulf.
Yeah, we're through 9 storm names already, with Imelda being the latest, and none have threatened the Gulf Coast of the United States. So I guess we should count those blessings and enjoy it and hope that it continues. What are you talking about today at GOSEP when you teach this class?
We've got some folks here coming in that we're doing a joint FEMA GOSEP sort of big picture fundamentals of threats and hazards. And of course, my job will be talking about weather. And so, yeah, we're going to talk about tropical weather. We're also going to talk about cold fronts and severe weather, thunderstorms and the like. So it's actually a 3-day class. I think we've got about 24 students from across the state here to qualify for their FEMA certification.
All right. If you were a betting man, when would you think we'll see that first real fall cold front?
I think we're going to get a taste of one before the end of the month, but it probably won't be until after the first half of October. So sit back, relax. Yeah, it is warmer than normal. It's going to stay that way through the month. But in general, the humidity is coming down a little bit. And now we're just waiting for that festival weather to finally kick in.
Yeah, let's hope we get a front in time for Halloween. Think it'll snow again this winter?
Somewhere, but it better not snow down here.
I meant here, yeah, because we got a foot of snow this past winter. So.
And not only the foot of snow, but the second coldest spell on the book record books. So I actually consider that event January to be the record winter event for South Louisiana. We don't need to repeat that anytime soon. Basically shut down the lower third of the state for about 3 or 4 days.
Yeah, kind of wild. So we don't need to order snow plows now. Jay Grimes, state climatologist, we'll let you go get ready for that class that you're teaching today. Thanks for joining us here on WWL.
You bet, Dave. Thanks a lot.
All right, let's check on WWL traffic. We're talking about how Lufthansa is going to replace 4,000 administrative jobs at the airline with artificial intelligence. It's just the latest announcement of major companies finding ways to replace human capital with AI. So another report about this new AI actress that Hollywood is going berserk about, because the acting community can't believe that there's even discussion of using artificial intelligence actors and actresses to make movies or television shows. And I made the comment earlier that this growth is inevitable. There's no stopping it. And you may as well embrace it, because trying to hide from it is not going to be successful. Every CEO of every major company is looking at how AI can help them improve their profit margins and their bottom lines. One person texts us and said, "You're a fool if you aren't using AI in some fashion." Somebody else texts us, "Dave, better watch out. AI might take your job one day." I would be shocked if someone doesn't try an AI radio show, just like they're trying AI movies and television shows and AI actors and actresses. I think there are very few jobs that AI can't threaten in some way, shape, or form. And I think that broadcasters and communications companies would be ridiculous not to at least evaluate how AI can help them. So no, I'm not a fool. I don't think that my job is safe from AI forever. But I also think there will always be, if you're the best of the best, there will be an opportunity for you. We'll continue the conversation after the news. The President of the United States addressed his top military leaders in a unique gathering yesterday. What did he tell them, and what does it mean for the future of our armed forces? Jeff McCausland is a CBS military analyst and a retired U.S. Army colonel. Jeff, thanks for joining us this morning here on WWL.
Dave, it's great to be with you.
Have you ever seen something like this before, where the commander-in-chief calls all of his military leaders from around the world to gather for what was billed as a bit of a pep rally, but also seemed to be a combination not only of a pep rally, but also as a bit of a dressing down?
Never. I mean, the word unprecedented does not describe this. I'm using the word historical, because I've only been doing this military stuff, Dave, for about 50 years since I was commissioned.
Oh, is that all?
That's it. I'm sorry. And I can tell you, in the last 50-plus years, nothing like this has ever happened. Now, do the generals get together? Sure, the four stars get together once a year. They meet with the Secretary of Defense. They meet with the President. That happens. Those are the major commanders. So each of the service have general officer conferences, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine. Yeah, that happens. Does a particular general officer who's in command of a region, like Pacific Command, call his generals together for that region? Sure. But for an administration that emphasizing trying to eliminate fraud, waste, and abuse to spend millions, and let's face it, this is millions of dollars to reach 800 senior officers, plus their sergeant majors, so that's 1,600 people roughly, from all around the world to one place, and then bring the Secretary of Defense and the President there. Imagine the security problem, just to begin with. Basically, for the Secretary of Defense to talk about appearances and for the President to give a political rally is, like I say, historical, if not certainly unusual.
What do you think comes of this in terms of, I'm assuming you listened to everything that Secretary Hegseth and President Trump had to say. If you had been sitting in that audience as a military leader, what would you have taken away from what you heard?
I would go home very worried, very, very worried, for a couple of reasons. First of all, the military and those general officers, each of which has an average of 30 or more years of service, all of them multiple tours in combat, several wounded, many have lost friends, all have lost soldiers in combat. And they're getting dressed down by a guy who voted the draft five times and a guy who spent a couple of years in the National Guard. That's got to be dispiriting to start with, number one. Number two, it's basically a political rally saying, hey, we want you to sign up to this particular political agenda. And they were threatened, if you don't want to sign up this agenda, you can immediately resign. You can walk away. And then finally, to listen to the commander-in-chief, who spoke for over an hour. And I got to tell you, Dave, if you can divine a theme in that particular talk, please let me know, because I couldn't find a theme. It was everywhere from talking about the stationery in the White House to his favorite war movie to tariffs to how much he dislikes Mr. Obama and Mr. Biden. And then at the very end, that would worry the military, is talking about the military now is going to be more involved in U.S. cities, on the border, talking about going into Chicago, talking about using cities as training grounds for warfare. And this would really, contrary to that civil military ethos, which is those officers swear an oath to the Constitution. They firmly believe, I assure you, they are servants of the American people, not any individual president. They defend the American people. They don't attack them in their homes.
So do you think, A, that any of those commanders will choose to retire or resign, as the president and the secretary suggested they could do if they don't want to get on board? Or do they say, hey, we can survive three more years of this. We just go back and do our jobs and hope that everything goes smoothly and we can survive this?
Each of them puts their head down, and each of them, I assure you, is thinking that exact question right now when they board the airplane going back to their commands. Some, I think, will quietly just resign. They just can't take it anymore. But more importantly, a lot of the comments that Mr. Hegseth made, which I found were somewhat, you could even suggest, racist or against women, about women and standards, et cetera, et cetera. I got to talk to you, tell you, Dave, I've talked to an awful lot of young women I know who are mid-level captains and majors. 18% of our force are women. We could not perform our mission as a military without women. And every one of those young women I've talked to said, I'm leaving the military as soon as I can. As soon as I get to 20 years, I'm gone. Or if I fulfilled my commitment from West Point or from ROTC, I'm leaving the military. That talent at that level is going to leave. And I think this will affect recruiting for women. I think it'll reflect recruiting for African-Americans and other minority groups as they listen to talk, particularly by Hegseth.
I know some people listening to you are saying, good, they should resign. They should leave. If they don't want to get on board, they should get out. Others are going, yeah, you know, these are leaders who have served through Democrats, Republicans, ultra-conservatives, ultra-liberals. They're used to the back and forth in terms of the administration, the commander-in-chief, and maybe some of the directives they get.
Yeah, exactly. But, Dave, I was at the Naval Academy as a member of faculty, oddly, after I retired from the Army. Colin Powell came down at the time prior to becoming SecDef, but, you know, former chairman, spoke to the midshipmen. And one of the big issues in those years, of course, was gays in the military. Forget about that. But, and a midshipman asked him, Mr. General Powell, what should I do if I cannot support that type of a position? And his answer, I thought, was telling. One, you owe it to the political authority to give them your military advice based on your
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday, because right now Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. And Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day. Yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit detecttheSOS.com today to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Experience and your analysis. You owe them the honest truth. Number one, and if you can't, and if you don't, can't convince them, and you can't live with what they order you to do, you got to live with yourself. And that's the time to resign. And I would say telling American soldiers and officers to attack Americans in their cities, which was suggested, you got to admit, I would call that, to me, an illegal order. That's an illegal order. That's against the law. I personally could be prosecuted for that under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And furthermore, everybody's got to get up in the morning, Dave, and shave and look in the mirror and say, can I live with myself?
Do you expect reverberating impact from not just this singular event with the president and the secretary addressing the military commanders, but the dominoes that fall as a result of it? Do you think that we see years of impact on the U.S. military, which has had to survive and thrive despite going through the changes of political winds that we have seen over generations in the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely, because three things. One, money follows policy. Money follows policy. So if you're going to start talking about homeland defense as the primary objective, then you're going to see the DoD budget changing and moving towards applying resources to that particular requirement. Take Golden Dome, for example. If you're really serious about Golden Dome and defending the homeland with a multi-layered ballistic missile drone defense, you're talking trillions of dollars, which aren't going to ships and tanks and other things. Number two, think about how our allies react. I mean, I got to tell you, I just came back from spending a week meeting with experts in the UK and Europe, and they were already worried about what was going on in the United States. And they are now going to be doubly worried as they saw Mr. Trump and 20 of his generals, frankly, give a rambling speech, which I got to tell you causes concern just about, you know, his health, his personal health. Number one, spend 5 minutes musing about how bad a nuclear war would be, and then talking about sending American troops into the cities. They're thinking to themselves this morning, number one, can we depend at all on the Americans? And they were very concerned about that last week. But number two, I happened to look quickly this morning at a German newspaper. And a German newspaper is saying, well, president is talking about, you know, a war in American cities. That's what they're reading in Europe right now. And then think about how this goes down in Beijing and Moscow. I think Mr. Putin and Xi are just delighted because the president is saying the United States is going to retrench. We're going to focus on the United States. We're not going to worry about the rest of the world. That's not going to be our problem. And talk about these attacks in cities and whatever, using cities as war training grounds. They know it's divisive, and anything that makes the United States even more divided or more polarized is welcome in Moscow and is welcome in Beijing.
I'm getting texts from people who think you're being anti-Trump or that you're ignoring things like record recruiting numbers in the U.S. military. How do you respond to people who think that this is your comments are political and not coming from someone with 50 years of military expertise and military as a military analyst and a retired Army colonel?
Right. Well, I would just say to them, I call myself an analyst, and that is I call balls and strikes, and people may not like my strike zone, and they don't, but I base that on facts, and I watch the speech, so I'm talking about what they said. So if any person there can, again, give me a theme to the president's speech yesterday, I'd like to read it. I just didn't see it. So my analysis suggested to me that's what this was all about. They could have had a really interesting meeting. He could have talked to them about a new national military strategy that's going to be released by the administration here, and what that means for them, and use it as an opportunity to do that. They could have, Hegseth and Trump, had an opportunity to listen to their generals. What's going on? That would have been a useful thing to do. But bringing them all together for a political rally and this rather discursive speech just didn't seem to me all that effective.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your service to our nation. Retired U.S. Army Colonel and CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland. Have a great day. Jeff McCausland here on WWL. All right, listen. The reason we had Jeff on was not so he would say politically popular things, but I wanted to know, with someone who has been there and done that, how are these military leaders, these generals, going to react to what they heard yesterday? The president said very politically popular things. Hegseth said things that the MAGA Republican crowd loved. But how will it go over with U.S. generals with decades of experience? You heard from a military analyst. What do you think? Share your thoughts at 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We're checking traffic now. Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Glad to be with you on this first day of October. Unfortunately, the federal government shut down at midnight for the first time in nearly 7 years. How will that affect Louisiana government and programs here in the state of Louisiana? To help us understand the impacts, we ask Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana, to join us. Morning, Jan.
Good morning, David. Great to be with you.
Glad that you're here. What, if anything, will we see immediately as a result of the federal government shutting down because of a political impasse in the U.S. Senate?
Well, it's hard to say. I think the answer for most people in Louisiana is not a whole lot. This is not a government shutdown. It's a partial government shutdown, which means that a lot of and the federal government, Donald Trump, has a lot of discretion in deciding who is an essential federal worker, and essential federal workers are staying on the job. So Social Security checks are going to keep coming. Medicare is going to continue to operate. The military, ICE agents, anything that was kind of appropriated in the big one big beautiful bill last summer, a lot of that is going to keep operating. Now, there are some things that are going to shut down, and one of them is paychecks. For there's about 19,500 federal employees in Louisiana, and whether some of them are going to get furloughed until this is fixed, and some of them are going to be forced to stay on the job. Either way, they're not getting paid until this is resolved. So if you're in that number, then this is going to absolutely affect you. Another big effect, obviously, if you're going to visit a national park or a museum, if you have plans to go to Washington, you're going to notice it immediately. The other big effect, I think, is the National Flood Insurance Program, which is how a lot of people in Louisiana get flood insurance, is shutting down. Now, existing contracts are going to stay in effect, but new contracts are not going to be written until this gets resolved And that's important.
So if your policy's up for renewal, or you buy a new home, or you want to buy a policy, you won't be able to do that as long as the shutdown continues.
If you're closing on a house this month and that house is in a flood zone, you're probably going to have a very big problem. So, again, most people aren't going to notice a change in their day-to-day lives. But if you are in that number, it's going to be a major change.
Yeah, that's a good point. I haven't even thought about that, because if you can't get flood insurance, you're not going to get a mortgage, and you're going to have to wait to close on that house unless you buy private flood insurance if your lender allows you to go that route. We're talking with Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana. We have a lot of federal workers in New Orleans, in Louisiana. How will they make ends meet during this time, and what impact will it have on those people who rely on federal workers to come and visit their businesses? We'll ask those questions after we check on WWL traffic. Talking with Jan Moeller, Executive Director of Invest in Louisiana, about how the government shutdown that started at midnight will be impacting us here in Louisiana. Jan, I'm sitting next to the federal building here in downtown New Orleans. Out my window, I can see Federal City across the river in Algiers. We have a lot of federal employees, not just at those locations, but around the city and across the state, who will not be getting a paycheck until this is resolved. And while they will be, the vast majority of them, reimbursed for lost wages and income when this is over, in the meantime, they still got to pay their bills. And for many of them, that's very difficult.
Absolutely. These are middle-class jobs. You don't get rich working for the federal government, contrary to what people may think. And so a lot of them rely on that income just to pay their bills, to put food on the table for their family every week. And when that income dries up, that's going to make that a lot more difficult, and it is going to reverberate and be felt in communities. Now, one good thing Congress did a few years ago, they passed a law that said people who are furloughed or who lose income due to government shutdowns will automatically receive back pay, full back pay, once the shutdown is resolved. It used to be that Congress would have to go in and actually pass a law authorizing that back pay, but now it's automatic. So anybody who's furloughed should expect to be paid back once they go back on the job. But a big factor here is, as we've heard Donald Trump say, he is prepared to play hardball and use this as an excuse to fire, permanently lay off some federal workers who might get caught in the squeeze here. We don't know if that's actually going to happen, but if I were a federal employee in New Orleans or Baton Rouge or anywhere else in the country, I would be a little worried about what's going to happen, because right now both sides appear extremely dug into their positions.
Yeah, many of these folks won't be able to pay their mortgages, their rent, their car notes, their utility bills and things like that. And we'll have to see how understanding those lenders and debtors are when those payments don't come because these federal employees aren't getting paid. And also, I remember last time this happened, a lot of the military folks at Bell Chase and at other institutions really had issues because they don't make a whole lot of money as enlisted individuals and get to a point where they're having trouble even finding money for the basics to sustain life if this shutdown goes too long, even though they'll eventually get that money paid to them.
That's exactly right. I mean, we know from a lot of research that about half of the families in Louisiana are really living hand to mouth, that don't have enough savings to sustain even a short or moderate period of unemployment. And so if this income dries up, yes, people are going to be wondering where their next meal is coming from. They're going to be calling that, power company and asking for a little extra time to pay their bills. It's going to cause a lot of real hardship in real people's lives. And so hopefully this will be a short shutdown. It's only day one. It's the first day of the fiscal year. It's fiscal New Year's Day for the federal government. Hopefully they'll get back to the negotiating table very soon. We should also note that there are some real important issues that need to be negotiated. The reason that Democrats in the Senate, and it's the Senate that did this, refused to vote is because healthcare costs for a lot of people. There's almost 300,000 people in Louisiana who buy health insurance through the federal health insurance marketplace. Those premiums are going to start going up, and the notices for those higher premiums are going to start going up this month. And so one of the reasons that I think the Democrats said they want to hold the line on this is because they want to extend the subsidies that keep health insurance affordable for a lot of people with low and moderate incomes in Louisiana and across the country.
And at the same time, the Republicans are saying, yes, we need to address that issue, but we need to keep the government running in the meantime. Let's pass the continuing resolution and then have that conversation. Yeah. So we'll see how this all plays out and how deep both sides dig their heels in. Jan, thank you for your insight and sharing that with us here on WWL.
Anytime. Thank you, Dave.
I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Coming up next half hour, LSU's football coach says his quarterback's not the problem. Others disagree. We'll talk with an LSU beat writer about where we're at with what is a burgeoning quarterback controversy for the LSU Tigers after the news.
This is not a Garrett Nussmeier problem. This is an entire football team of guys doing their job at a higher level.
That is LSU football coach Brian Kelly after the loss that the Tigers suffered at Ole Miss, when many analysts and fans increasingly disagree, saying the Nuss bus has a mechanical problem and may need to be put in the shop for repair or at least rest. What do you think? 504-260-1870. Do you think that Garrett Nussmeier, the quarterback for the LSU Tigers, who started the season as one of the Heisman Trophy favorites, has just not performed up to snuff and, we have learned, has some sort of torso injury that may be inhibiting his ability to accurately and powerfully deliver the football? Cokie Riley is the LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Hey, Cokie.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well. What do you think about Garrett Nussmeier's performance? And many analysts and fans are increasingly saying there's something wrong with the Nuss bus. Do you think that Garrett Nussmeier is the problem?
Yeah, I think saying that the Nuss bus has a mechanical problem is definitely an accurate assessment of the situation. And when I say mechanical problem, I mean like a literal mechanical problem. Like, I think he has some sort of injury that he's dealing with, and he just doesn't seem confident in his ability to drive the football downfield and to really turn those hips and put his full body into these throws. And you can just tell that it's just not quite there for him right now. I don't think he is the only problem with this offense. Like, I think the lack of a running game really hurts him, especially when he's not 100%. So it's kind of the combination of those two things, the lack of a running game and the fact that he's not 100% and he can't really drive the ball downfield. And if you can't do those two things, it's really hard to put points on the board.
You know, the Ole Miss defense was, on the vast majority of plays, only rushing three linemen. And Nussmeier not only was having trouble connecting because of the additional coverage downfield, but he was zero threat to run the ball himself. You would think normally if there's only three rushers on almost every play that the call would be for the quarterback to at least have the option to take off with the ball. But when he did, he was very ineffective, and he only did it, what, once or twice?
Yeah, and part of it's because he's not moving very well, because I don't think he's very healthy at the moment, and he just doesn't look as athletic and fluid as he did last season. And I don't think it's because he suddenly got old. He's not 40. Like, this is a young guy and should be able to move pretty well, and he's a good athlete, and we know that. And I just really think that he's playing injured right now, and maybe this bye week can do wonders for him, and he comes back in 2 weeks and he looks like himself again. But right now that's not the case. And when you're, as you said, when you're facing those three down linemen and teams are putting eight into coverage, you should be able to run the ball, right? Teams aren't really concentrating on the run in those situations if they're dropping eight. And this team's inability to run the ball and defense's lack of respect for LSU's running game, it plays a pretty big factor into this as well.
You know, college football, the rules are a little different about what coaches have to tell us and what teams have to tell us about injuries. Coaches in football, in professional football, have to issue an injury report, have to tell us players' likeliness to participate in a game or if they participated in practice. In college, Brian Kelly is under no requirements to do that and can flat out mislead the media about an injury, correct?
Yes. But usually he's been fairly more open than other coaches are when it comes to injuries. With this Nussmeier situation in particular, I think they're just trying to sort of guard the fact that he's not as hurt, so it doesn't become an excuse for the way he's performed. And I think that's almost more of a directive from Garrett himself than it is from Kelly. Because remember, Kelly was the one who mentioned the torso injury, not Garrett Nussmeier. Garrett Nussmeier has been the one who's declined to comment any sort of questions regarding his health, not Brian Kelly. So I think when you keep that, I think Garrett wants to make this an excuse for the way he's played, for the way his team has performed, the way the offense has played. And he just doesn't want that to be the focus, but it has been the focus because everyone's watching these games. Everyone's seeing how he's moving out there. So I think it's better for him and for the team just to admit what's going on right here, because to me, it's pretty obvious.
What do we know about the specifics of the injury, if anything?
Yeah, it's a torso injury. It's something he's been dealing with since the preseason. Ryan Kelly telling us that he was on a bit of a pitch count during the preseason where they kind of limited his throws, and they hoped that would sort of subside the injury. And against Clemson, I guess it kind of worked because he looked pretty decent against Clemson. He looked fairly athletic, like good old Nussmeier. But then as the season has sort of worn on, it kind of looked worse and worse. And he looked a little bit better against Southeastern, and then it got a little bit worse again against Ole Miss. And I think there are some instances where he can deal with it and he looks like himself. And then there are others where he gets hit once or twice and it sort of re-aggravates the injury and he doesn't feel like himself again. And that's more of an educated guess, the latter half of that. But this is something he has been dealing with since preseason. We know that for sure.
Talking with Kiki Riley when we come back, we'll talk about the backup quarterback for the Tigers. Haven't heard much about Michael Van Buren. Is he an option for this LSU team if Garrett Nussmeier does not show market improvement after this bye week? We'll talk about that after we check on WWL traffic. Talking with Advocate LSU beat writer Kiki Riley about the Tigers. As LSU has a bye week before taking on South Carolina a week from Saturday, if Nussmeier continues to show these issues with accuracy and strength of passing with this injury that he's suffering, what do we know about Michael Van Buren, his backup?
Yeah, Michael Van Buren, he's a transfer from Mississippi State, actually played in a whole bunch of games last year. I believe it was started eight games, had some decent moments. He's a pretty good athlete. He's much more a runner than Nussmeier is. But when we saw him play in the preseason, it seemed like he had a lot of work to do, especially from an accuracy and consistency standpoint as a passer. Just didn't really seem like he had it. He didn't look like an SEC starter, despite, he is the backup after all. But, despite that experience he had last season, it didn't really seem like he was ready to take over the offense if needed. And that's something to just sort of keep in mind here. Again, it was the preseason. This was a couple months ago. But it's definitely something to keep in mind.
So maybe a banged-up Nussmeier is still better than a healthy Michael Van Buren?
I think potentially, yeah. I think it all kind of comes down to how hurt Nussmeier is exactly. That we're still not 100% sure about. Maybe it's not just the torso issue. Maybe he's dealing with other issues. Maybe the bye can really help him out. Like we don't know for sure. And I feel like Van Buren could be an option if he's really not ready to go. And Van Buren looked good against Southeastern, but again, it's Southeastern Louisiana. Garrett Nussmeier also looked very good against Southeastern Louisiana. So I think for now it's probably best to go with Nussmeier as long as he can go. But if he can't go and if it's just becoming way too detrimental for him to play, whether it's for his own health or for the team, then that's when you can turn to Van Buren.
Brian Kelly in his fourth year is under intense pressure. The expectation at LSU is championships. He hasn't even sniffed a championship yet. I'm getting a lot of texts on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talking Text line at 504-260-1870 from people who are questioning if Kelly should continue to be the coach. How hot do you think his seat is right now?
I would say it's fairly hot. I think they have to make the playoff this year. I think that was the expectation coming in. When you come to a place like LSU, that I think that's fair. And they haven't done that yet in the last 3 years. And if they don't do it this year, that's 4 years straight. And the progress of this program, they had to be within that 12-team playoff. And they've been on the outside looking in pretty consistently. And you see a lot of the same issues that you've seen the last few years, whether it's, you know, one side of the ball is a major strength and the other isn't. The other is a major weakness. And you saw it 2 years ago where LSU's offense was incredible and their defense was abysmal. And now it's kind of, now the script is kind of flipped on that 2 years later. And that's just kind of where this program's at. And you kind of see the mental mistakes in terms of preparation. You see the mistakes when it comes to untimely penalties or just the issues that have kind of consistently popped up outside of just, you know, one side being stronger than the other. So, it's going to be pretty concerning if you're an LSU fan. And I don't think he's going to lose his job after the season, in large part because of that buyout. It's a really, really big
number. $40 million. Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's $40, $50 million. And they don't really have the scratch for that at the moment. But I think
just
maybe
takes one wealthy booster. One wealthy booster can solve all the problems.
Depends how motivated you want to be, right?
That's right.
It all comes down to motivation, how bad it gets, really. So, if they win 8 or 9 games, I don't know if you're going to get there. So,
Gokie, thank you so much. But I don't think fans are going to wait. I mean, the last time they won the championship was in 19. It's coming back to the Superdome in 28. I don't think LSU fans are going to wait till 2028 for another national championship. Well, I just let my wife pick the house, so I use neither logic nor intuition. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Courtney. We'll talk to you coming up here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. Joining us now on the live line, Kevin Doliel, the Director of Aviation at New Orleans Armstrong International Airport. Good morning, sir.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Welcome to October. Can you believe the year is three quarters over already?
Oh, gosh, it's flying by.
Flying by. See what he did there? He works at the airport. All right. Also flying by is the time since I didn't realize this. I had to look it up this morning. It has been, next month will be 6 years since you opened the new terminal out there at MSY. 6 years. Does it
Very
feel
true.
Like it's been that long?
It doesn't. I mean, it's almost like just yesterday we moved over. But it's been a look. It was definitely a labor of love to deliver the project. But it's certainly been a pleasure to be here in this facility, and it's functioned very well. And we've received great recognition around the country. Even when I travel, just hearing from my peers in different locations as they've used the facility, just speaks volumes, I think, to the good work we did here.
Yeah, congratulations. Didn't J.D. Powers just move y'all up in the overall rankings and have very kind words to say about the airport here in New Orleans?
Yes, they sure did. And it's really great to be among the top 10 airports in our category in their customer satisfaction study. It really shows and reflects on the hard work we've done, not in just delivering physical facilities, but in delivering good customer service to the users of the facility. And that's across the board. That's airport aviation board staff, the airlines, various tenants in the airport. So it's great recognition. I tell you, besides that, we were also...
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here. Wishing you a very happy half-off holiday because right now, Mint Mobile is offering you the gift of 50% off unlimited. To be clear, that's half price, not half the service. If Mint is still premium unlimited wireless for a great price. So, that means a half day, yeah? Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
I'm caught up in the game. My attention is on every play and every whistle. But what I'm missing is a signal coming from my kidneys. That signal isn't like a ref's whistle. It's more of a silent SOS, which could be warning me of an increased risk for events like heart attack or stroke. And a way I can catch that signal? A simple urine test called UACR. If you have type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure, talk to your doctor about the UACR test. Detect the SOS. Visit detectthesos.com to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Number one in their survey a few years ago. And we've also ranked first as best airport in North America in our size category by Airport Council International World Airports Service Quality Survey Program. For the last 4 years in a row, we've been ranked the top airport in our category.
Yeah, great customer service, according to these reports. Great food, according to these reports, and which you would expect in New Orleans. Yes. So congratulations on that. And, you know, I remember, and, you know, the conversation about building the new terminal goes back clearly years before the 6 years ago that you opened it. And there was a lot of debate and discussion and public conversation about whether or not the $1 billion it would take to do it right would be worth it, and whether or not that was an important factor in people's decision whether or not to visit New Orleans and whether it would pay for itself over time. And here we are now, 6 years after you opened it, and you're already talking about having to expand. So I guess you have told the naysayers that y'all were right and that this was a good move.
It was definitely a good move, and you're right. You picked up on as we master plan the facility. We're completing the final phases of a master plan, and it is reflecting definitely that we need to go back into the development mode pretty soon here. As the projected traffic five, six years down the road is showing a need for more capacity. So we'll be in that mode. You know, master plan gives you conceptually how you can go about meeting your needs down the road, but with the finalization of the master plan, there's a lot of work to do before you even have a program set up to deliver. There'll be further refinement of the concepts. Will be further validation. Then we'll move into design phase. So it's a good bit of work to do yet, and a few years down the road, before we would see any actual activity on the construction front. And that's really driven by projections holding up over that period of time in terms of employments and so forth, or projected employments for the market.
Talking with the Director of Aviation at New Orleans Armstrong International Airport, Kevin Doliel, about the new master plan that they've been working on. We have it posted at our website at WWL.com. You can also see it at FlyMSY.com, the airport's website. And right. You talk about projections, but you've also seen past performance. Tell us about the growth that we've seen in the number of passengers coming in and out of the airport over the last 6 years since you opened the new terminal.
Well, we actually had record traffic in 2019, the last full year before opening facility. But as you know, a few months after we moved in, we came over in November of 19. In March of 20, the nation was sunk into a deep a deep slowdown due to the pandemic. So traffic actually fell through the floor through the pandemic and has been slowly coming, you know, creeping back up amongst airports to where at the end of 24, I think we were at about 98% of 2019 traffic, which, by the way, was a record year for travel. So we were getting back there, pretty much back to 19. And then this year, there's been a nationwide softening in demand for air travel due to a number of reasons. Some I would not even very carefully tend to offer up, but I think we all know it's been a little bit of an interesting year to this point, and the aviation industry has felt it as well. So we've been impacted nationwide with a softening of demand. But as our forecasts reflect, there's the expectation first that this is temporary in the industry and that our traffic will hit a certain trend line upward over the next several years, hitting a certain point 5 years down the road that's going to drive the need for this for the capacity.
Yeah, suffice it to say, economic uncertainty has been an issue for many Americans. And we talked actually earlier this morning about we're seeing trends across the country with people going on fewer dates now to try and save money, with people consuming less alcohol to try to save money, and other ways people are cutting back while they wait to see how the economy and their personal economies play out. And clearly, when you talk about discretionary spending, vacationing and even business travel has to be at the top of that list for so many people, right?
Very true. And I'll say, too, something I should point out that even as the nation's going through this period of soft demand, airlines are still committing to this market. Breeze Airways, amongst others, but I have to point out Breeze first, strongly committed to this market. You know, when Breeze started operations, we were named one of their five operations bases in their total system. An operations base is a commitment on a part of that airline to a maintenance operation with maintenance leadership in place and a crew base. That's pilots and flight attendants that are actually based here in New Orleans. And that's a good commitment on a part of an airline. But so they were committed to this market to begin with. And then they just announced that we're one of, I think, five airports in their system where they're about to, for the first time in their company's history, starting international service. They just went through a certification process with the FAA. And to be named as one of the inaugural cities for international service with Breeze really speaks volumes about our position as a premier destination and our airport's growing connectivity. And it also speaks to our importance to that carrier and their overall network and their continued commitment to this market. So it services Cancun, where others serve it, but it's big in that we're in that inaugural bunch of cities that Breeze is giving international service to. They also launched seasonal service to Tampa, Florida in June of 25, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Savannah in September, and will begin nonstop daily flights to Los Angeles and Las Vegas in February of 26. But let me note, others are committing too, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention others after going on about Breeze Airways. Alaska gave us Portland, Oregon in January of this year, Allegiant to Punta Gorda, Florida, starting in November. British Airways is going strong at five times a week during their peak months. Delta gave us Austin twice daily. Frontier announced in February they'll initiate service to DFW, Baltimore, Detroit, and Houston. JetBlue resuming service to Lauderdale. Spirit, after giving us San Pedro Sula, and that's done well, began twice per week service to Tegucigalpa in May of 25, and then United to Chicago and Houston. So it's been a good period.
Yeah, far less layovers in Houston, Dallas, or Atlanta, huh?
Yeah, right.
All right, I'm going to pause you right there. We're going to come back with Kevin Doliel, Director of Aviation for Armstrong International. We got to get to a break. When we come back, we'll find out some other good news. Also find out when there will have to kind of be decisions made on whether or not to move forward with this master plan based on projections for a new additional terminal out at Armstrong International. And what's up with this connector road? We'll find out from Kevin Doliel after this. Armstrong International Airport is working on a master plan that calls for a new terminal to join the recently opened terminal down the road because of expected increase in demand and passenger travel. We're talking with Kevin Doliel, Director of Aviation for Armstrong International. And you said you'll have some time to see if these projections bear the fruit that they're expected to before you have to kind of pull the trigger on trying to move ahead with constructing a new terminal to adjoin the existing new terminal. What's the timeline on kind of deciding if and when to try to move forward with that project?
And let me note too, Tom. I'm sorry, Dave. It's more than just a terminal. It's additional capacity in terms of additional gates for the airlines to operate from as well. And on our forecast, in a high-growth scenario, we would need 15 gates by the 2031 time frame. In our baseline growth over that period, we would need 10 gates, which baseline would be a little less in a high-growth scenario. So in any event, we need terminal and gates to satisfy our capacity needs. So the time we have really, if all bears out as traffic is forecast, and these forecasts aren't done by, as you know, not by us. It's aviation economists that are expert in what they do and in projecting what type traffic you should see down the road. But if they're going to hold as projected now, we need that capacity by 31. We actually need to start getting busy now. As I mentioned earlier, refining our concepts and then eventually off that going into a design mode. And that buys you, you're good, year and a half, 2 years down the road before you actually make final decisions on timing of the program. And what components of it you're going to bring online. You have that time. In any event, it's more a matter of not if you're going to do it or not, it's the timing of it. So you need to get busy with refining concepts and into the design mode in the not-too-distant future.
Where do you envision, and I know the planning's still underway, but where do you envision these additional gates, this additional terminal going on the footprint of the current airport or off the footprint of the current airport?
There's two different ways we could do it. Probably the preferred is to go all west with our gate expansion. So as you visualize the current facility, the Concourse B is our furthest west finger, if you will. And then Concourse A is a linear concourse that goes a little further west from B. It would be more in that direction. It'd be another some extension of that linear concourse, and then another finger off it.
So would that still be all on Jefferson Parish land, or would you be expanding into St. Charles Parish?
It would be all on Jefferson Parish land.
So that's one option you said.
If you can picture the current FBO site, our general aviation activity, we'd be growing that way.
Gotcha.
But still within Jefferson Parish. We extend into St. Charles Parish only the last maybe 1,000 feet or so of our east-west runway. Everything else is Jefferson Parish.
Gotcha. And how would this proposed expansion be funded?
Airports use a variety of funding sources for projects like that. Airfield work, you get a lot of federal grants to support our programs. There's what's called a passenger facility charge would be in the mix. It's PFCs. It's that $450 charge you might see on your airline tickets occasion. We could float debt as one of the sources that then would be supported, would be serviced through the rates and charges that we charge the air carriers that use the facility. So there's different ways to go at it and attack it. A lot of federal funds, there'd be state support too. As we acquire federal funds, there's a state program that supplies some component of the local match to us as well. So the state's been very supportive in that, too.
All right. And again, that master plan and the documents and the vision that you have painted, we have that information, including a new video you released recently on our website at WWL.com. And, of course, you can go to FlyMSY.com for more information. Before we get to all that, you are working on this, what, $84 million connector road. One of the biggest complaints we do hear from folks is that if you got to go to the long-term parking or you got to rent a car or you have to use a shuttle, that's a long trek right now that generally requires going off of airport property and getting back on it. This is aiming to solve that problem, huh?
Absolutely. And and you're absolutely right. If we hear anything in complaints outside of a baggage delivery maybe and a TSA checkpoint on occasion, it would be the shuttle route from the south side facilities to the north terminal. So as you know, we service a economy parking garage on the south. Our employee parking is over there. The rental car operation is over there. And eventually, which this road will service too, eventually with the New Orleans Baton Rouge passenger rail, there is an airport stop that will connect to on the south side of the across airline highway from the south facilities. So all of that will be in the mix and using this roadway. What this roadway does is it pulls all of our shuttle traffic, and there's a good bit of it moving to the tune of 9,000 people a day. We'll pull all of that traffic off the public roadway system onto a dedicated airport road that stays on airport property, working from south to north and connecting into the north terminal facilities. It eliminates several traffic signals, traffic lights. It provides more consistent headways and timing to get around and much shorter time to move around the facility. It going from south to north right now, we could pretty consistently do that in the 11 to 14 minute range from south to north. Coming north back to the south is just unpredictable, especially during peak periods when there's a lot of traffic on Veterans Highway. Our shuttles get caught up in that, and the headways and timing to move around can grow quite a bit from the time it takes to move from south to north. So this will eliminate that issue, and you'll have consistent shorter timing in both directions moving back and forth. And important, too, as this roadway is being constructed, it connects our two campuses. We're on 1,500 acres here, which is a small footprint for an airport serving a market of this size. We can meet all of our demand needs going forward well into the future, but it's going to be critical that we have both sides of our facility connected in this way. But also, even more immediate, this roadway will serve as a pathway eventually if we go to autonomous vehicles on the route. or it can serve as the base to an automated people mover system as well.
Ah, yes. So you don't have to worry about traffic and roads and things right. like that if you're going to have some sort of rail or self-driving vehicles or anything like that. Far fewer exactly. conflicts to deal with there. We're out of time. I appreciate your joining us. Kevin Doliel, Director of Aviation for Louis Armstrong International Airport. Thank you for shedding light on all these issues with us and letting us know what the future looks like there at Armstrong International.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. All right. Coming up after this break, a new poll on the race for mayor of New Orleans. Is it still looking like the front runner, Helena Moreno, can win on October 11th without a runoff? We'll find out. And today marks 100 days until the switching of the mayor in the city of New Orleans. 100 days left for LaToya Cantrell. What should we expect in her final 100 days under indictment in office? We'll find out after this. 9:40, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Thanks for joining us on this hump day, the first day of October of 2025. We are 3/4 of the way through the year. Before you know it, we'll blink and it'll be 2026, and we'll be inaugurating the next mayor of New Orleans in just 100 days. Joining us to talk about that is Ed Chervenak, professor of political science and pollster at the University of New Orleans. Good morning, professor.
Good morning, Dave. How are you today?
I'm doing well, other than the fact that, you know, here we are back in the 90s for highs on the first day of October. I would prefer some crisp, cool air and to go out and enjoy some public pumpkin spice something or another, but not in the mood with the temperature in the 90s. But we'll survive, right?
Yes, we will. We've been through it before.
So 100 days from Inauguration Day, 100 days left of the Cantrell administration. What do you think... As the mayor sits under indictment for the first time ever for a sitting mayor of New Orleans to be under federal indictment, we should expect from Mayor Cantrell over the last 100 days. I can't remember seeing her out publicly. I've heard a couple of reports of people seeing her eating or drinking at restaurants or bars. But the only public event I can recall her having since her indictment was the Katrina anniversary, and even then she did not talk to reporters. She merely appeared at the event, gave an address, but did not interact with reporters. What do you think happens for the next 100 days?
Well, you know, she's still the mayor, so she has all the power and privileges and the responsibilities that come with that position. That she's certainly entering lame duck status, and so we're probably not going to see any new initiatives or proposals from her administration. But, you know, today that they are submitting the budget to the city council. So obviously there's still work to be done. If she, you know, wants to finish on a positive note, I would say, you know, finish projects that are already underway, you know, anything nearing completion, infrastructure, street repair, drainage. See if she can push to complete that and then publicly highlight those accomplishments.
Do you expect her to do that personally? Do you think we'll see public appearances from the mayor, any news conferences, any really public events? She didn't have any really for a while before the indictment and has had only that one I can think of. If she didn't show up for a ribbon cutting she was supposed to be at, I mean, we just haven't really seen her at all.
No, we haven't seen her. She's kind of receded into the background, and I expect that's what will continue. She doesn't want to, you know, be confronted with questions about the indictment. So I think she's just kind of, you know, maybe she can try some finishing projects, but I think for the most part, you know, she has zero political capital. There's really not a whole lot that she can do.
Yeah, we don't have a precedent for it in New Orleans, and I'm trying to think of other significant precedents of incumbents who are under indictment for corruption cases and how they've been able to function or not. Can you think of any precedents for that we've had in the past?
I can't. The only mayor who was indicted was the former mayor, Ray Nagin, but
he was
never
out of office. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So it's difficult because it's a distraction, you know, for the city, and it's certainly a distraction for her. But she still needs her administration still needs to continue to do the work to, you know, so that the city can continue to function.
Well, or continue to not function so well, because that's been one of the primary issues in the current mayor's race, as we transition to that, is that the city has not functioned very well at all in recent years, and much of the focus of the race has been on how to fix that. You don't see any significant fixes in the last 100 days under Mayor Cantrell.
No, I don't think there's going to be any major, like I said, any kind of major proposals or initiatives. It's just maybe she can finish up some of the projects that are already nearing completion. But you're right, you know, people aren't happy with the current state of affairs. The mayor's extremely unpopular, and most people believe the city is headed in the wrong direction.
You just completed a new poll. Did you ask about the current mayor or the direction of the city in that poll, or was it solely focused on the future and the current candidates looking to replace her?
No, we asked about the mayor, and we also asked people about what they thought about the city's direction. And what we found is the majority of people, 52%, believe the city is headed in the wrong direction, and that most voters also strongly disapprove of Mayor Cantrell's job performance. She's only at 20%, only 20% give her positive marks for her performance in office, but 51%, majority, strongly disapprove of her performance.
Wow, that's 20% approval.
Those numbers are stunning. You're absolutely right. Those are historic low numbers.
What did you find about who the voters want to replace the current mayor?
Well, Councilmember Helena Moreno continues to hold a commanding lead in the mayor's race. The results we found, she's at 49%, and that's consistent with what we've seen in previous polls. And that Moreno is also viewed as the change candidate. She's drawing strength from voters who are dissatisfied with the mayor and also unhappy with the city's current trajectory. She's been able to keep her multiracial coalition intact in this poll, and so she's at or near the threshold to win the office on October 11th.
Yeah, how did the other candidates perform in the poll, and how many still are labeled as undecided and may or may not even vote?
Well, we've got Royce Duplessis at 15%, Oliver Thomas at 13%, 3% said they wanted to vote for someone else, and 20% say they're still undecided. So there's still a block of voters up for grabs.
So based on all that, if 20% of the people, and early voting is already underway, we're actually halfway through early voting, continues through Saturday, and you did this poll right before early voting started, but if 20% are still undecided, based on your past analysis and knowledge of how campaigns and voting works, will most of those people vote, or will they just not vote since they can't pick a candidate? And what does that mean for Moreno's chances if she's definitely got more than 50% of the decided vote right now? She needs more than 50%, obviously, of all of the votes that are cast to avoid a runoff.
When people say they don't know, they're either undecided, unsure, or unwilling, to express their preference. And so it's really difficult to gauge exactly what they're going to do. I assume a number of them are maybe unwilling. They know who they want to support. They look to see who's in the lead, and then they may show up and vote for that person. Or that they're just so unsure and undecided that they decide to stay home. Now, one of the things our poll did find was that chronic voters were heavily in favor of Helena Moreno. These are the folks who have voted seven or more times in the last 10 elections. And 54% of those people said they plan to support Moreno in the election.
So that puts a lot of pressure on Duplessis and Thomas then to get the infrequent voters, the non-chronic voters who support them, to actually show up if they want to force her into a runoff.
Right. Their goal is to keep her under 50% plus one to force a runoff with, one of those, either Duplessis or with Thomas.
I'm guessing with those chronic voters numbers, that bodes well for Moreno. And with the high number of undecideds this close to election, that's got to bode well for her as well. When you take the entirety of all the data you have now, and your knowledge of past elections and how they unfold, when you have 20% undecided and a candidate with 49% of the overall vote and 54% of the chronic voter vote, if you had to lay a bet right now, would you bet on Moreno winning in the primary or not?
If I was a betting man, I would say she has a very strong possibility of winning on October 11th. All the numbers are in her favor. She's, you know, viewed as the change candidate. She's at 49% overall, but she gets 60% of the vote from those people who disapprove of Mayor Cantrell. So they're looking at Moreno as the change candidate.
She's overwhelmingly the antithesis of LaToya Cantrell.
Yes, absolutely. It's the same with the direction of the city, that if people feel the city's moving in the wrong direction, she's receiving the majority of support from those people.
Very interesting, and we will find out. How has the improved and increased opportunity and usage of early voting, do you think, impacted this campaign? Now we have four early voting locations. We're seeing strong early voting numbers after consecutive elections with very low overall turnout. And with so many undecided heading into early voting, how does that affect this campaign?
Well, over the past 3 days, what we've seen is an increase, 62% increase in early vote compared to the same time 4 years ago. So people are showing up. I think it's nearly 7,000 more early voters have showed up over the past 3 days than 4 years ago. So people are energized. They are showing up for early voting.
Ed Chervenak, pollster and professor of political science at UNO. Anything else you want to share with us about your recent poll or about this mayoral election?
The biggest takeaway from the two city council at large races was that the large number of people were undecided. Nearly half of people were undecided in those contests. So still a lot of voters out there up for grabs.
Yeah, and the sheriff's race also. It looks like we will have some runoffs. We'll wait and see if we have it in the mayor's race or not. Professor Chervenak, thank you for joining us here on WWL.
All right, thanks, Dave. It's always a pleasure.
All right, talk to you soon. He's Ed Chervenak. I'm Dave Cohen, in for Tommy Tucker. We should note that there are also elections in some 30 other parishes. Most of them are ballot measures, tax issues. There's a mayor's race in Slidell also with early voting underway and election day on October 11th. Go to our website at WWL.com and you can check your sample ballot and your voting locations so you can see what's on your ballot, if anything, in your parish and where you would go to early vote. When we come back, we'll check in with Newell Norman to see what he's working on for the next 3 hours and see what you're texting us on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. Do you think Helena Moreno will win in the primary and be the next mayor of New Orleans? At least, will be ready to become the next mayor of New Orleans on October 11th.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
You're jamming your favorite song, and while you aren't missing a beat, you could be missing a signal from your body. It's an SOS from your kidneys, and it doesn't sound like music at all. It's silent. High blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and other risk factors can quietly stress the kidneys, leading to negative impacts on the heart. That's why you should ask your doctor about a simple urine test called UACR. Most miss the signal for hidden kidney disease and related heart risk. You shouldn't. Visit detecttheSOS.com today to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
Did you know your credit card points and miles can lose value to inflation? Credit card companies often reduce the redemption value of your points and miles. Now, imagine a credit card with rewards that can grow in value. With the Gemini credit card, you can earn Bitcoin or one of over 50 other cryptos instantly with no annual fee. Every swipe at the store or gas pump earns you instant rewards deposited straight to your account. Plus, sign up now for a $200 Bitcoin bonus to kickstart your rewards. Visit Gemini.com/card today. Check out the link in the description for more information on rates and fees. Again, if you're looking to invest in Bitcoin but don't know where to start, the Gemini credit card makes it easy.
The Gemini credit card is issued by WebBank. In order to qualify for the $200 crypto intro bonus, you must spend $3,000 in your first 90 days. Terms apply. Some exclusions apply to instant rewards in which rewards are deposited when the transaction posts. This content is not investment advice, and trading crypto involves risk. For more details on rates, fees, and other cost information, see rates and fees. The Gemini credit card may not be used to make gambling-related purchases.